You're listening to The Mumcast, the best weekly comic book podcast recorded in Southampton, England on Thursday nights.
In our 143rd episode, we talk about this week's comics, and Jane, in her spotlight, talks about Madame Xanadu, Volume 1. That's it. That was easy.
That was. You forgot the last part, right?
What do you normally say?
Then you have to say, around the mic tonight.
Oh, yeah. I can do that. Around the mic tonight are...
Hello, I'm Jane.
And I'm Nick. And that's it.
Not as easy as it looks, is it, Nick?
No, it's confusing. And I'm not normally this drunk.
Oh.
I'm not drunk.
He's compensating because we're missing somebody.
We're missing James. He died after last week's show.
Oh my god. He didn't. He's alive and well.
He sounded really ill though.
Yeah, but he was fine the next day.
Oh, okay. So he literally was just ill for the show.
No, he was ill for a couple of days before the show.
Oh.
And I think a little bit after the show.
Oh.
But he was fine the day after the show.
His timing is shit. How are you, Jane? What have you been up to this week?
This week I went to the Goodwood Festival of Speed on Saturday, spent 4 hours in traffic, and looked at some motor vehicles. It was much fun. Got horrendously sunburnt, though.
Mm.
But because I got sunburnt in the car, I've got a trucker's suntan at the moment.
Which is what one arm is burned.
Pretty much. My left side seemed to have got caught the sun more than my right side, but it was definitely my neck and part of my chest that got the brunt of it.
I had a lift home with Alex tonight, and the car was very hot when we got in it, so we put the windows down, and I put my arm out while we were talking because it was like cooled me down a little bit. And Alex, despite the fact that we were talking to each other, forgot that I was in the car when he decided that the air conditioning was up to speed enough. So he automatically closed both windows, and I almost knocked my glasses into my nose as my arm flailed up, and It was distressing. But so what else have you been up to?
That's pretty much it. It's been an average week.
Work weeks are kind of very...
The story goes on week.
Yeah. And the weather's not been very nice, so it's not like...
No, it's been pretty unbearable at some points when it's been raining and horrible, but you still have to wear a raincoat even though it's freaking boiling.
Really warm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really muggy, humid.
I've moved into a new office this week with a bigger office with more people, and so it's been quite... work itself has been quite hectic in a way that's boring to talk about. Because it hasn't been hectic with work, it's just been hectic with like working out new cultures and stuff, which is very, very strange. And I can't even remember the weekend. This week has been strange enough. But I did go and see Amazing Spider-Man last night with Amy and Domi and her partner, and Alex and his...
Hi, Alex.
And
hi, Domi.
His wife, his long-suffering wife. Does it count as long-suffering if they've only been married for a little while?
No.
They've been with each other a while.
Isn't that just suffering?
I don't know. Does the long bit...
So she would have been his long-suffering girlfriend, and now she's just his suffering wife.
All right, until they've been husband and wife for a bit longer.
Yeah.
6 months in Alex's case, I think. So we went and saw Amazing Spider-Man and with Oki as well, and that was all very exciting. Oh, my friend Oki had this epic 30th birthday party where she invited all of her family up from wherever the hell it is they're from, and took over a pub.
Pretty south.
I think what you do when you live in a city is everything. The city you're in is the pinnacle of everything, so everything else has to go up to it. Certainly everyone I know who lives in London does that, so I assume it must be the same for any other decent-sized town.
I just thought they lived on the Isle of Wight. That would be up.
That would be up, that's true. And where did they come from? Oh, I can't remember, but that was nice. But that was like a whole day on Saturday of drinking and eating burgers that hadn't quite been cooked all the way through.
Oh, dear.
And dealing with vaguely stroppy bar staff. They weren't that stroppy. They were just a bit disinterested. You know how young people are. That was my week as well, actually. They have been pretty weird weeks, haven't they?
Yeah.
Is it just that we don't have James to sort of...
No, I think James would be the same as well. Although, no, actually, he'd be... If he was here, he'd be sad but excitable because it's his daughter's birthday today.
Actually today, isn't it?
Yes. And yesterday evening, that was one thing I did. I helped James and his lovely wife, Nicola... build a toy kitchen for babies. Well, not so baby Scarlett now.
For her to see when she got...
Yeah, when she woke up the next day.
So. Do we know what happened when she's...
No, I have had very limited communication with James because they went to Peppa Pig World today.
Did that used to be called something else?
No, it was Poulton's Park, but now it's Poulton's Park with Peppa Pig World
attached.
Yeah.
That seems like marketing. That's all. I don't know.
Well, if you ever went to Poulton's Park as a child, you would understand why they've done it. Poulton's Park was never really... It wasn't a place for one fixed age group. You sort of went because it was close and it seemed like a good idea at the time.
What is it? Does it have...
It's got a bit of everything. It's got a little bit of a kind of a bird sanctuary zoo thing going on. It has some pretty mediocre rides... there's a maze there.
What's the best animal it's got there?
All I remember really is the flamingos, but I could be confusing that somewhere else.
Flamingos are boring, they're just birds.
They just stand around, like, oh, I can stand in water easily.
So no lions or...
Oh, I can do it on one leg.
Hippos or...
No.
Or do you see what pandas.
I mean? Mediocre, didn't
that it? That is, mediocre as hell. But I have to wonder what Peppa Pig would be like. Having never seen the show, I don't know what a world around the show... would be like.
Yeah, I do have fond memories of Poulton's Park. My parents don't, though, because I was quite a tall child, so I'd get onto rides I wasn't supposed to get onto, but I'd run off and get on the ride. And one time, to my parents' horror, I ran off at one point, and my parents couldn't quite catch me. I jumped through some bushes, and my dad ran after me to follow me through the bushes to his absolute... amazement as I had jumped into a pond, jumped into one of those little motorised boats, but there was a very long queue of angry parents who had been queuing for the ride, and he had to apologise as he jumped into the pond to rescue me from the boat.
Wasn't a very deep pond then?
No, it was very shallow, so...
That's good.
Yeah.
That's a night. You were a nightmare.
Only at Poulton's Park.
Oh, okay.
Probably because it didn't cater for any particular age.
Well, it sounds like a very strange place. I'm glad I will never probably have to go there, ever.
There, Moors Valley Park. Moors Valley's better.
I like Marwell as a zoo. I like it. And I very, very particularly like Monkey World for days out.
I think everyone likes Monkey World.
Because of the monkeys.
Yep.
What's your favourite monkey at the Monkey World?
Oh, I don't know. They're all pretty rocking.
You know the ones I don't like? I don't like the macaques.
They're the little ones.
Oh, no, hang on.
Are they little ones?
Which are the ones with that they rescued from laboratories and they've got horribly disgusting arses that they show you all the time? Might not be macaques.
I don't know.
I'll look it up and I'll put it in the show notes if I remember.
Because everyone needs to know.
We should tell people how they can get hold of us.
Yep.
You can leave comments for us in the on the webpage that this is on, or on iTunes, which I presume you'll be able to find because you're listening to it already. But it's momcomics.com is the website. You can email us at...
momcast@gmail.com.
And you can find Jane on Twitter at...
Jane Mom.
And you can find me at Twitter at NickSight. And there's James Momb and John Momb, but there's no earthly reason why you'd want to talk to either of them.
No.
And we take contributions for the show of 2 to 5 minutes of audio long, and you can ask us questions and you can tell us we suck.
Yep.
Or we rock.
Yeah.
There are so many people already telling us we rock, though. You don't need to worry about that. There aren't. No, there are, actually. Always, aren't there? There are
always,
few.
Everyone.
Well, no, now
all
that,
of our listener.
Although now
us.
That Lee Gallagher's not on Twitter anymore, we don't hear it from him often. He does off. Send us emails now.
I know, he's off licking somebody else's face. He's left us cold.
That is so weird.
And wanting more.
There's so much face and general body licking going on these days. I find it very peculiar.
Isn't he crazy, Nick? You should get on board.
Have you heard the story about my wife and licking? When she was at university, she vaguely remembered on one drunken night licking a girl's shoulder, an attractive girl's shoulder, but she didn't remember much more about it than that. And then several years later, we met a friend of ours. We made a friend who is a female friend that we really like. And it's pretty obvious. I've kind of spoiled the story a little bit. We found, after knowing her for over several years, that it was actually her that my wife had licked the shoulder of. They both remembered on a particular evening. It was a bit peculiar.
That is peculiar.
Yeah. That's one of the best Amy stories.
When you said to my wife and licking, I thought this maybe isn't appropriate for people under the age of 18.
No, but I think that's fine. A light lesbian activity, I think, is okay.
I think the shoulder's a safe zone.
If you're heterosexual, if you're a heterosexual female, does licking a girl count as light lesbian activity or light bisexual activity? The activity is lesbian, isn't it?
I think it's just odd. Licking a girl's shoulder or a boy's shoulder is just odd.
Is it?
Yeah.
It's not sexual.
No. It's an androgynous zone.
An androgynous zone. As opposed to an erogenous zone.
Yeah.
It's an androgynous zone because it's not sexy.
Yeah.
That's very clever. You're sometimes very good with words.
Sometimes. Not all the time. Not when it counts.
When does it count?
Probably in more important situations than a podcast.
Yeah, like a wedding.
Yeah, that would be... wouldn't really want... Yeah, I shouldn't speak at a wedding.
No.
Or say anybody's name that I, in my head, can say right and also say wrong and keep saying the right one over and over again, but end up saying the wrong way.
Does that happen often?
My brain regularly screws me over.
How, have you seen Game of Thrones yet?
No.
We're talking about brains screwing people over, and one of my favourite pastimes this week has been my colleague Alex, who we've already mentioned a few times, is very susceptible to suggestion. So it doesn't take very much, and at least twice this week so far, I have been able to, just by humming the first bit of the Game of Thrones music, to get it stuck in his head for the rest of the day.
Oh,
it's
earworms, yeah. Yeah.
It kind of goes... Dum bum ba dum bum ba dum bum ba dum bum ba dum bum. That should be enough if he's listening to this.
Hi, I'm Alex. Sure he's thanking you for it.
Should we talk about comics?
Yes.
What comics did you get this week? It was a quiet week, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, to go with the story continues weeks we've had, it also continued into the comic book world. This week I picked up Dahl H for Hero.
Mm-hmm.
By China Meaville.
Meaville, yeah, I'm not sure.
And Mattis Santoluco. Yeah, I always wanted to say Lance Santalucas. I want his name to rhyme.
I don't understand his name at all.
Yeah, the story continues. I think I'm going to have to read the first two issues because this is a really batshit insane comic as it is. Yeah. And we've really just been thrust into this story. And it's been epic. Really enjoyed it. But at the same time, like, I really, really have got to the point where I'm not really sure what's going on anymore. I know there's a phone that you can dial, but doesn't always work, and you can dial it a lot or not a lot, and you become different people every time you do it, but sometimes you can be the same people, and you may not be that person for very long, but you could be that person for a long time.
It might not be that you've missed anything. It might just not have explained any of that stuff.
Maybe.
Yet. The first issue is batshit.
It is, and I think because it's crazy. It's very fast. It's a very fast-paced comic. There's lots of stuff always going on. I don't know anything about, as I'm not supposed to, with the New 52. I don't really know. Oh, that's the assumption. I don't know anything, and I genuinely don't know anything about the character or the story or that kind of part of the universe. So I think I'll probably do soon is reread the first three issues back to back. See how it goes. Still lots of fun though. The artwork in it's amazing. Some of the crazy characters that come out of this phone are just you look at it and think, what?
It's still a completely different one every time, is it?
Well, there was somewhere he... Nelson, the main character, mm-hmm. our main protagonist, he can be the same character more than once, but obviously it doesn't seem to be sequential and it can be...
they're not getting any control of it.
No, he hasn't got any control at all. In this issue, we're learning a bit more... He's learning more about how it works, so I think perhaps we're going to learn more with him. He still doesn't get it, though.
Mm.
And it seems that it isn't as straightforward as you turn into whatever selected hero you're going to be. There is almost a residue of that hero within you.
All right.
And it's just, he's not really... He's trying to learn to cope with it, so it's... still insane. Still good value. $2.99, though.
Oh, and, it's one of the good ones.
Yeah. Wonder if it's something that perhaps... I do encourage people to pick things up in floppy, because that keeps the book going. Mm. But something that I think would be quite good as a trade as well, once it's eventually collected. I think it'll collect quite well.
I think that might be... I might look at it in that form. I did buy the first one and liked it, but, yeah, it's quite dense, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. So. It's committing to it. The second comic I picked up was one of six of Before Watchmen.
Do you want me to say it, or are you going to try?
Ozymandias.
I think that's right, yeah. I think that's how you say it.
By Len, we think, Vane?
Ween? No, ween?
Ween.
Or Wine.
Or Wine.
Uh-huh.
Or Vane. And Jay Lee.
Yes.
I unfortunately missed last week's. I'm not sure who last week's was on. I could probably find out from this issue. But we're still getting the introduction of each character. So I'm sure I can go back and...
Still on the first issues.
Yeah,
still
on the first issues of everyone. And this issue was, as I have with all the others, just really enjoyed it. It was really, really, really good. The artwork in it is amazing. I know we go on about artwork fitting stories, and that should be pretty much a given. But this one... You know, a lot of it complements and it tells the story perfectly and there's no interruptions. But with this one, it promotes the story a bit more, promotes the character. You get a sense of his greatness, how superior he is. Not, you know, in an arrogant way, but a nice level of arrogance, not an overly arrogant way. But rightly so, because he is very, very intelligent. He has made such wise moves with what he's going to do. We learn about, essentially, the character from him as a... As a child, his name is Adrian, and we learn about he's an immigrant. Well, his parents are immigrants of America. They moved from another country during just before the start of the Second World War, and I can't remember which country it was. Europe's on the brink.
Not Wales.
No, he's not okay. Welsh. Europe's on the brink of war. His family leave Europe to go to America, as at the time they do. That was the in thing, to go to America and have a new exciting life. The main reason his parents move is because his mother was pregnant with him.
Mm-hmm.
So they want to start a life in America. His parents are quite humble, not poor, you know, relatively comfortable, but, you know, still had a humble, they had a working sort of life. His father owns a perfume shop.
Mm-hmm.
From a young age, you can see Adrian's brilliance and how he, you know, excels at everything. But his father's very keen for him to not stand out too much, more for his own good.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, as a child, things change as you grow up. But as a child, it can be considered a bad quality in somebody, which is sad. But it's something you need to do, something that's advice in this particular book for him to survive. I know it's not spoiling it because people
We kind of know where he ends up.
Yeah, because people know the characters. But, you know, if you're new to The Watchmen, you should definitely pick these up if you're curious. I know there's been corners of controversy about this. I have purposefully not tried to find out why, because I'm enjoying it and I want to just leave it as that. Yeah. It's hard to
it's hard to avoid,
it really is. I do see it, and a lot of people do talk about it. They feel very strong about it because they obviously had quite a love for the original book itself, but I didn't know Watchmen before you know, became...
Before the film or anything.
Yeah, before the film or anything like that. So, yeah, really good issue. Another great introduction to another really, really interesting character, so...
The Jay Lee's art is... I really like his work anyway. There's a really keen sense of design and stuff like that. And he does do epic. He does do quite...
Grand.
Big, grand stuff. Grand is a much better word than epic. But all of the stuff I've seen from this book, all of the art I've seen from this book has been absolutely brilliant. So, yeah, it did look really good.
Do you know, I don't think he refers to his home country or his parents' home country.
He just came from Europe.
It just says the old country.
Oh, or the old country. Well, that's Europe.
it says Europe, yeah.
So. As I mean, I think if for an American audience, that's fine.
Yeah.
Anyway, that covers everything. That is a bit of a catch-all.
Just east of us, isn't it, really?
Yeah. So, but it's you liked it, yeah?
Yeah, I liked it. I will continue to pick it up, and I will make a mental note to get it out to my standing order so I don't miss one like I did last week.
Damn it.
I know. What did you get, Nick?
First thing I want to mention is I picked up, I guess it's like a zine, it's American comic-sized... magazine called Your Days Are Numbered, which I believe is a quarterly magazine. It's all text, but it's all interviews with comic creators and designers and stuff like that. This particular issue has an interview with Rian Hughes, which really delves into design and typography and stuff, which he's really interested in. And an interview with Jeff Lemire, which I haven't read, but I wanted to mention it because I know James really loves Jeff Lemire. And it was free from Forbidden Planet. I think it might come out of Gosh Comics in London, or nope. It comes out of yourdaysarenumberedmag.com. So yourdaysarenumberedmag.com, I'll put that on the on the site. I'll talk a little bit about Amazing Spider-Man the movie later on. I've picked up Amazing Spider-Man 689, which is written by Dan Slott with art by Giuseppe Camuncoli and Klaus Janssen on inks. The previous issue was all about them curing the vampire... not the vampire, I'm getting confused. Dr. Morbius and Spider-Man curing the lizard, who... I believe that they've timed this story to match up with the villain of the movie.
Okay.
I don't believe it. It's obvious, actually. But they cure him of his lizardiness, but it turns out he's still that personality that was clear at the end of the last issue. So Spider-Man and Dr. Morbius, the living vampire, Spider-Man's mistrusting of Dr. Morbius, the living vampire, while at the same time... the lizard is trying to get himself turned back into the lizard.
Okay, so is he a man now then?
He is a man with only one arm. He doesn't have the other arm. I'm putting one arm behind my back to show Jane what that would look like. And that's kind of that's why he developed this serum, because some lizards can grow limbs back.
Yeah.
But it went out of control. And this is he's one of Spider-Man's oldest villains. And he's got quite a sad story because he didn't mean to become this. He just wanted to help himself, have another arm, I guess, and initially. But now he's like a proper monster, and it's interesting because Dan Slott's handling that. Dan Slott's obviously sort of talking about how being the monster isn't just about. Him being a monster isn't just about whether or not he's physically a monster at any given time. There's still this element of it there in him. But Kurt Connors works out that the best way, that there's a mistrust of Dr. Morbius, the living vampire, on Peter Parker's part.
Mm.
It's interesting because we've come off the back of Spider-Man saving the world.
Yeah.
And I've kind of mentioned a couple of times that I think that Peter Parker's stance on nobody dying around him is a little bit crazy.
Yeah.
In this story, it's really Peter Parker's impetuousness that is making things worse.
Yeah.
He's so angry with Dr. Morbius and so convinced that he's right that he's not noticing the other stuff that's going on. It's quite interesting. It's not as epic as the previous story, but it is quite interesting seeing how these characters play off against each other. It reminded me a little bit of a run on a comic called Spectacular Spider-Man ages ago, which was all about how the different villains sort of interact with each other and stuff. It's pretty cool. I like it. I'm really enjoying Dan Slott on there anyway. I've never really cared that much for the Lizard, but it was nice. It's nice seeing this story.
Yeah,
I get
to know more about them.
The other comic I wanted to talk about properly is The Cape 1969. I didn't know this was coming out.
I saw it on a shelf. Mm. And then I was a bit sort of thinking, was that coming out?
Mm-hmm.
I thought it finished. So
The Cape did. The Cape is a pretty self-contained story set in the present day about... I talked about every issue of it, pretty much, about two brothers, one of whom is a slob who finds this cape that he... this, like, little thing that he used to use as a cape when he was a kid that gives him the power to fly. Now, it hadn't ever really occurred to me that there was much to be explored about where the cape came from. It was quite a decent self-contained story. But this... this comic is going to reveal some of the mystery behind it, behind the cape. It's written by Jason Ciaramella, who I think wrote the first one, with art by Nelson Daniel, and I'm not entirely sure. I've seen his art before, but I don't think he did the first issue of this. I think he might have done the Road Rage story, story, but I can't remember exactly. But it's about the... There's an opening panel that tells you that basically it's going to be about the father of the two boys that were in the other story, who is in Vietnam. He's a medevac pilot in Vietnam whose helicopter gets shot down and who ends up behind enemy lines and is trying to evade the... Viet Cong.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much all that really happens in this story without going into actual detail. All that happens in this first issue. I'm not entirely sure how long a series it's going to be, but to be honest, I didn't realise it was going to be about uncovering the mystery of the cape. For some reason, I'd decided when I started reading it that it was mainly going to be about explaining why their father wasn't around and seeing if that plays into why the kids turned out the way they did. And actually, in terms of that, it holds together quite nicely as a Vietnam story.
Yeah.
There's a very slight hint of mystery in a double-page spread that suggests there's something slightly weird going on. But otherwise, it's just a straight down the line, behind enemy lines Vietnam story. The art's pretty nice. It's quite a violent comic.
It looks very military. It looks...
Yeah, the colour palette's really nice. Colours, I think Nelson Daniel must have done the colour as well, because I can't see a colourist on here. But yeah, the colour palette's really nice and military, and the jungle scenes are really, really good. It's good. It's a good comic. I mean, it's $3.99, and if you haven't read The Cape, which I believe might have just come out in hardcover, actually, it might not mean anything to you. It's one of those stories that could be a standalone thing, but it's difficult to say at this point, really. But I like it. I really enjoyed The Cape, and this is very different from that. But that was good. Worth mentioning, Creator-Owned Heroes 2 came out this week. It's actually not bad. It's $3.99, and it's got two very short episodes of the ongoing story. Actually, they're not that short this time round. Trigger Girl 6 and American Muscle. Excuse me. And a whole bunch of back matter that I haven't even had a chance to look at yet. Interviews, photographs. I think there's an interview of Paul Pope in here and some pictures of one of Jimmy Pariotti's female friends. And it's good. And 2000 AD continues to be delightful.
I do really like the cover of 2000 AD.
Yeah, you like that. Yeah. Durham Red cover. I haven't been reading that story inside, actually, but I know that James swears by her. It's good. I mean, the thing that's quite exciting is that apparently the very last episode of Nicolai Dante, which has been running for 15 years, is in the next issue. So that's quite exciting. I've only really enjoyed Nicolai Dante since James and I got back to reading 2000 AD recently. Yeah. I never used to like it very much, so that's quite interesting. It'd be quite exciting and epic and cool. Stuff.
Thank you, Nick.
You're very welcome. I think I just want to mention that I saw Amazing Spider-Man. Yeah. We talked a little bit about what the point of a reboot is and all of that stuff. It's actually, and I think that we might be getting a review up on the site, but not by me, about it. I liked it. It is a long film. It is talking about the downsides to it. It is covering the origin again, although slightly differently, but it is basically the same, that same story again. And it, pacing wise, it's a little bit peculiar because it looks like one of the Christopher Nolan Batman films in terms of how beautifully it's all shot. New York looks amazing, and all of the Spider-Man stuff, everything in it looks really lush. It's like shot like a, I hesitate to say a proper film, but it's shot in a really beautiful, rich way, as opposed to the
cartoony almost way.
The Avengers movies, I guess the Avengers family of movies, are much more bright primary colours and stuff like that, whereas they're still amazing looking. But this is very like rich and
more gritty, maybe.
Well, it does all look much more real. It's kind of hyper-real.
Yeah.
And it looks nice. The only problem is it kind of applies the same sort of quite slow pacing and melodrama to things. But it's just over 2 hour long movie.
Gosh.
And which is about normal. Actually, that's about
normal.
I know,
we've spoken about this before, but it's still a lot of time.
I don't get fidgety watching a decent film over like a certain length, but if I know a film, if we've got a DVD or something and I know the film's going to be over an hour and a half, that hour and a half seems like the right length for most films. This one does have loads in it though, and I actually think that's the main thing about it. It's quite dense with plot lines, and one thing I think is that it almost would have been better if it had just focused on the main core of Spider-Man's origin, because all of the actors in it are brilliant. Everyone in it is really good, and Martin Sheen and Sally Field play his aunt and uncle.
Oh.
And so you've got the relationship between Andrew Garfield, who's brilliant.
Yeah.
He's really good in the role, and them, when they're on camera together, it's brilliant. It's exactly what you want from that relationship. Yeah. But it's kind of swamped out a little bit by a lot of the other stuff that's going on.
Do you think they're packing too... Was it a film that you felt they packed too much into? Perhaps they could have had another film out of it? Or...
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And there are things in it that definitely point to them planning, like, at least another, probably a trilogy. But it almost... There's almost too much of that stuff.
Do you think it's an overcompensation? Because they're conscious it's a reboot, and I might be contradicting what I was talking about last week, but they're conscious of reboots, so they're worried that people are just going to think, oh, another Spider-Man
origin story.
Spider-Man film, so they put more into it. Because they did it with the Batman films. I mean, we thought it was just a trait of Nolan, just making amazing films. And I know I've spoken to different people about it. I love Batman Begins, and I loved The Dark Knight as well. They were long films, and there was a lot in there. And you could see, you watch them, you could get more. You could get two films out of this. You could have had four films by now. But you wonder if the back of the minds, oh, hang on a minute, we've already done this before, so maybe we need to put something else in here.
Maybe. But having said that, if you go right back to. Although the films are longer now, if you go, one of the things that has bugged me a little bit about all of the superhero films that have happened in the, probably since the first Batman, the first Tim Burton Batman film, although the first one isn't so bad actually, so probably from the second one, is this insistence that you have two, this isn't the case with this Spider-Man movie, but that you have two villains. And you have at least two origins. You have at least two origins in every film and stuff, and that's true of the most recent Batman. Yeah. And so, you can't just have characters introduced. There has to be an origin and all of that stuff, which I genuinely think, and I probably got into a little bit last week, I genuinely think you don't necessarily need to do that with an action film. You can, if there's enough of an emotional core to it, like with Spider-Man, it doesn't even really matter how he got bitten. That can be a really, by the radioactive spider, that can be a really quick scene. The thing that turns him into Spider-Man is really simple, and it is something that most people can relate to. He gets cocky in his teens, he lets something happen, and someone he loves gets hurt, like, really badly because of it. And that basically tells you everything you need to know about him. I'm not even a purist about the original comics that much. But one thing I felt watching this film, and it might even have been the case with the Tobey Maguire one as well, I just don't really remember, is that it doesn't... Yeah, they don't need that. You could make just an hour and a half film and have a lot less in it, and you'd be less likely to annoy people as well. Because, like, most of the things... A lot of the problems with Prometheus... A lot of the problems people had with Prometheus and a lot of the problems people have with most of these films are plot points that... The more plot points you have in something, the more scenes you have in something, the more likely you're going to do something that just annoys people, when you might as well just keep it short.
Yeah.
The reason people love Die Hard is it's basically just him running from one desperate action scene to another. And... You get the sense that you get a sense of his character without having to know why he makes every single decision he makes. And most of the really good action films that people like the most, I think, are a bit like the end horror films, are a bit like that. The more story you put in that isn't absolutely necessary, the more you're going to wind people up.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
One thing, though, about the criticisms people I've seen about it, about Amazing Spider-Man, and I've been thinking this since the criticisms I saw of the first Ang Lee Hulk movie. People are going to have to get over the fact that CGI is just the easiest way for them to do these things. And if you aren't on board with the idea that there isn't... They can't just hire a guy who happens to be a 6-foot-tall lizard to come in and do those scenes. They're going to have to do it with special effects some way.
Yeah.
And I've seen a few people talk about how like rubbish the CGI is on it, and watching it, trying to speak objectively about it, I'm watching it and thinking there isn't really any way you could make a 7-foot tall lizard look more realistic than that. I don't know how you can do it.
I'm not a fan of the original or the first Hulk film, but it wasn't because of CGI. It's just I prefer the remake, the later story.
I think people made the same complaints of the Ed Norton film as well, I think.
There seems
to be something people complain about.
There's a lot. Well, in both films there is a lot of CGI, but I preferred the story in the second one. But the one thing I do want to ask you, because I have not seen The Amazing Spider-Man, but I have seen the trailer. I'm not a fan of Spider-Man. Is it another victim of the trailer not doing the film justice? I saw the cinema trailer.
I'm trying to think what it has in it. There's lots of swinging around.
Yeah.
The swinging around mainly focuses on the first person stuff, which there's only, I think, in the trailer, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Which there isn't that much of in the film. There's lots of... somebody referred to it as Peter Parkour, I think, in the trailer. Yeah. There's lots of that from his point of view, running over things. Yeah. That most of the time you see him, it isn't really like that. And I think the bit that you see in the trailer where he jumps and he sees his own reflection, that's only a very small bit. It is quite melodramatic, I don't think the trailer does it justice. No. It is a good looking film.
Yeah.
It's a really good looking film.
Well. From the trailer, wasn't impressed with it. I'm, you know, put aside the fact that I don't like Spider-Man, I wasn't impressed with the trailer, and it did just look a bit crap, a bit cheap, a bit shiny.
It just introduces you to all the characters and doesn't really do very much with them. The other big problem with it, actually, and it isn't their fault at all, I think, is because Sam Raimi used Mary Jane Watson, he used Mary Jane Watson and they cast Kirsten Dunst in that role. It meant that I guess it's possible that they made all the decisions deliberately, but Emma Stone is great, but as Gwen Stacy she is a more vivacious and interesting Gwen Stacy than I ever remember there being in the comics. She feels a lot more like she'd make a Mary Jane Watson really well. And actually, Kirsten Dunst would probably make a better Gwen Stacy too. Mm. So, but they couldn't really help that. I mean, they couldn't possibly have, if they'd put Mary Jane in these ones, that would have been too much, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah.
Again, it would have been a clear, like a straight, another version of the first film.
Yeah.
It isn't another version of the film. It's just another version of the Spider-Man origin.
Yeah.
So when we talk about reboots, that the one thing I was explaining to a friend talking about it today is, I understand why people who only really watch the films get a little bit irritated about it, but I don't understand why comic readers might get irritated about it, because you see a couple of, if you read Spider-Man comics, you tend to see at least one version of the origin every year,
yeah.
pretty much done by different creators. Yeah. So it's kind of a little bit...
Just another view on it, another take on it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, but it was good. I enjoyed it.
Mm. I don't think I'll go to the cinema to
Worth
see
seeing
it.
On DVD, really. Probably.
Yeah, I'll probably see it on DVD. And that's not because based on I want to see it's based on your review. It's, I just think Spider-Man's just whiny and annoying and needs to grow up.
Yeah,
needs to grow up.
Andrew Garfield
get over your superpowers.
Funnily enough, the script or the stuff that he goes through is probably a bit more like grumpy making. They have him more as a sulky teenager than I think they had him in the Tobey Maguire one, but he's more charming. He's more fun and funny. The bits where they're sparking is kind of he's lovely. I really like him. He's good. And Emma Stone's just gorgeous. I think that's it for weird stuff. I don't think has anything happened in comics this week? That you've noticed? I haven't really noticed anything.
No, not that I've noticed. We're probably missing something really important. But we're just being consistent then, aren't we?
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
Hello, monkeys. It's Maxi again, coming at you like a beam, like a ray, like a beam, like a ray, like a kiwi. After last week's dog noise debacle, I decided to use all this time where I'm not being employed by the hundreds of jobs I've applied to down at my local library. That takes ages to walk to, so it's not really a local library, but it's the best I've got. Reading whatever comics and the like they have there to pass the time, which is varied, and one of just about two places that actually have comics here in Nelson, which is fun, and actually kind of refreshing being away from all the bullshit of comics communities. Anyway, one of the books I read was so exceptional to me I felt I should talk about it on here, and I am. After this sentence... It's called Smile, it's by Raina Telgemeier, and it's the most I've enjoyed a comic about the teeth of a young girl in forever. Admittedly, it's the only comic I've read about the teeth of a young girl, but shut up, I want to talk about how it makes me feel gooey inside. This sounds wrong. For those who don't know, and if you don't, then forget you, because I'm an elitist sort who thinks you should all be able to peek into my mind, see what I think is important, and immediately look it up, you swine, you filth! Why don't you think what I think? Why do you all suck? Get out! Come back when you love me! Smile is an autobiographical work of Raina's younger years, where due to an unfortunate fall one day after Go-Guides, Brownies, I can't remember, her two front teeth were irreparably damaged. So we follow her over the graphic novel when she endures near enough 5-year process of having her teeth reset, drilled, filled, burnt, removed, pushed together and such in the attempt to give her a normal looking set of teeth. This all alongside the torturous strife and drama kids already go through, with changing relationships with her friends, crushes, puberty, bullying and the like. And that's where the most interesting part lies. All that teeth stuff is interesting in its own way, but the way it relates to those things that anyone who was a kid can empathise with? It's super strong. I can only speak for myself, but puberty in the years around it was some of the shittiest and happiest of my short life so far, depending on how personally deranged I was at the moment. And seeing someone else's genuine experiences and comparing them and contrasting totally made it work. Not just that, but imagine being a kid reading this. If you're the same age, then it's probably the Holy Grail, which might be hyperbole, but all I'm thinking is I wish I had this when I was a young girl as something to connect my feelings to. One thing in particular is her relationship with her old friends as the story goes on. They become cruel and snide to the point of pranking her one day by pulling down a skirt in front of everyone on the playground. The build up to that and the breakup that follows, and even the civility after that, are so true to life, well, because they purportedly are true to life, that my heart went out to Mrs. Telgemeier. And, you know, that's not just because I've had a horrible breakup with my friends recently and there's this weird civility now. Ignore that part, I didn't say it out loud, I don't talk about feelings like that. Smile is good comics. If I were a complete dick, I'd say it's a part of the future of comics. being a material far removed from that uncomfortable niche of superheroics and firmly entrenched in relatable all-ages experience, which really every comic should be. I mean, forget all your grown-up mature things. I want all ages, all the way. Yeah, elitist, I said. So if it's at your library or in a bookstore, pick it up, you bastards, and drop the mic.
Are you going to do your spotlight,
Jane? I am. Spotlight time. Obviously, James and I have spoken about Justice League Dark. Mm-hmm. We have similar opinions on it, but this is my first, you know, it's a mixture of lots of Vertigo characters now into the mainstream, some I'm familiar with, some I'm not. One that I am very familiar with is Madame Xanadu. Mm-hmm. I picked up the Madame Xanadu comic. It's one of the first ones I picked up.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, on a monthly floppy.
Did James point you at it because it had a girl in it?
No, James pointed at me because it was brilliant.
All right,
and he did so, and I took his advice, and I'm glad I did. I picked up as it was, unfortunately, on its last breath of the run, so I got some mileage out of it, but then it, as we know, as the Curse of the Mooncast, we got cancelled.
We cancelled that one.
And it didn't... I would have loved to see more, and I'm very pleased that Madame Xanadu's back in Justice League Dark, but she's not the main focus, and especially at the beginning of Jeff Lemire's, now he's taken on, she's not in... Well, I'm issue behind, but she wasn't in the beginning of the new arc, so I missed her a little bit. So I needed to fill a Madame Xanadu gap.
Void.
Yeah.
You needed to fill... Okay, there isn't a way to make that sound
dirty. No, there isn't. No, not at all. this is... I'm not sure... I think there's only two trades, and this is the first trade by Matt Wagner. Oh, look at me, I can say his name.
You said
now.
It right.
Yeah, Amy Hadley Reader and Richard Friend. I'm a massive fan of Amy... I said her name wrong. Amy Reader Hadley. Sorry. Amy Reader Hadley. I'm a massive fan of her artwork, so I was really pleased to be able to go through it and see it again.
Did she do the whole of the first arc? Oh, okay, that's cool.
Yes.
Because it had lots of artists on it, didn't it?
That was in one of the later runs. Yeah. They had a mix-up. They had different female artists doing the stories, and that was brilliant. One of those stories will always stay with me. Mm-hmm. I think Amy did some, and I think Richard Friend's did some as well. In the back of this trade, there are the issue covers, which I always love when you get that. You get to see, and they obviously had guest artists doing the issue, doing some of the covers, and they're really cool. This is an origin story.
All right, okay. That's fair enough.
Obviously, in the first chapter, we learn about Madame Xanadu and her roots, and she is old. Mm-hmm. She comes all the way from King Arthur's time.
Really?
Yes. She was much more powerful back then as well. And she was old when she was in Arthur's time as well. She was 600 years... No. She was... she was... she's a majestical... person. Yeah. She has core magic, and that's, you know, her powers. Well, not powers, magic, isn't it? She was the friend of the forest, so she lived in the forest, and she was very considerate. She's very humble, and she protects everything around her. She was very respectful of the things around her and what gave life and what gave life to her and people that lived there. So she's a very innocent person at the beginning. We learn about this in the first chapter. You learn about the story of her and her relationship with her sister Morgana.
She's
in right from the beginning, which I didn't she appeared in later issues, so I was quite I was surprised that she was that far back into the story. We saw her straight away. Morgana has always been Morgana, greedy, angry, you know, wanting everything for herself and not really caring about anyone else, including her siblings. So we learn about Morgana, and there is quite a fight going on at the beginning of Xanadu's story, as we know it. Morgana wants to take power because she has an illegitimate child with King Arthur, who will not recognise his child. Mm-hmm. So she wreaks revenge on him and his kingdom, and you see the fall of King Arthur. Xanadu she's trying to do the right thing. This is where I say the innocence comes in. She wants to help. She wants to stop this. Mm-hmm. She can see into the future, so she knew it was going to happen. So she wants to stop it desperately. Along the way, the stranger appears, who we see throughout the whole...
Phantom Stranger.
Yeah, yeah, I think it's Phantom Stranger. Yeah, yes, it is, sorry. We see throughout the whole of Madame Xanadu's story. And it first appears here. He knows her, she doesn't know him, which is bizarre. And it's you learn later on, you learn a lot more about how he operates. But he is pretty much telling her that she can't stop this. It's happened, it's done, she can't stop it. But what she must do, which we find out, is that she's in a bit of a relationship with old Merlin.
Oh, really?
I know. Never thought he had it in him.
No. Is he an old dude at this point?
He is an old dude, and this is where a point comes up with Madame Xanadu's age, because she's very young, she looks like a teen. She, part of her magic, she can make herself look youthful. She takes a potion, she knows what to do, so she makes herself youthful. So Merlin, you find out, isn't just after Xanadu because he loves her and she's the almighty beautiful creature that he adores. She has power that he wants, and it turns out that Merlin is pretty much out for himself.
He's a dick.
So the stranger says to her that she has to, you know, she has to entrap him, basically, and stop him from what he's going to do next, and that's her purpose. And she's like, no, he's not like that. He's not like that. You know, he wouldn't do that. And then, as you find out, Merlin is, as the stranger said, and does try to betray her and takes him for magic. Madame Xanadu, she's not Madame Xanadu at this point.
She's just Xanadu.
She's not even Xanadu just yet. She has a different name. It's a very ancient, folky name that I can't remember, because it's not uttered very much past this one beginning. Nemu. She's Nemu in the beginning. That's her name.
Is Merlin, when she falls for him and makes his excuses for him, is he wearing a black leather jacket and riding a motorbike?
No, he's got he's a wizard. Like, he's got his Merlin cape and his Merlin hat and his Merlin beard.
Teenage girls, young girls, they'll always make excuses for a guy in a leather jacket or a motorbike.
I think she loves him for his mind and his abilities. Unfortunately, it's not really, he's making out to be something that he isn't in some respects. And that's again, this is where you see her innocence coming through, even though she's much older than she appears. She still hasn't, she's lived quite a straightforward life so far, and hasn't had to encounter this kind of betrayal. I mean, she encounters Morgana's betrayal from her own sister, and also then from someone who was her lover. She does entrap Merlin, and Merlin's passing gift to her for doing this is to... he almost, I think it's a curse or a spell on her, but takes her power, basically. So she is... she's not mortal, but she's near mortal. And that's... Okay. And she doesn't understand why the stranger isn't more grateful for what she's done. She's paid a very big price to deal with the stranger's wish. And not for the first time, the stranger leaves her in her situation. Yes. I'll talk about the second chapter, but I'm not going to do this chapter by chapter. Okay. Just these two are very different from the rest of the stories and what later becomes the second arc of Madame Xanadu. In the second story, Xanadu gets her name Xanadu.
All right.
She's lived hundreds of years by now. She ends up in Emperor Khan's time.
Oh.
And is... is it Sikh? I think she's called a seer. She's seer to Emperor Khan, and she likes being in his kingdom. He's very good to her. He's got he's very good to everybody in his kingdom. He's just a nice guy at this point. And he for the first time, they are just about to, you know, she's got this way. She's been, you know, making her potion to keep her young, but she has aged because she hasn't got the magic she once had. She tells Fortune, she's his, you know, confidant when it comes to matters that he's concerned about. Westerners are coming, well, not Westerners, Europeans are coming to see him, one of them, Marco Polo.
All right.
Yeah. And she, obviously, Madame Xanadu has foreseen this and has said, you know, this is a good thing, this will bring great things for you, it's going to be a really good relationship between the two sort of parts of the world. And especially Marco Polo, you know, you will, it's Marco Polo. Mm. You'll definitely, you know, he's young, he's going to be your man, you know, you will create a great friendship for him, which will reward both of you. Mm-hmm. And what she foretells is true. As the Europeans enter the kingdom, I guess it is, she warns Khan of one particular member of the party who is not to be trusted. She's concerned there's something wrong about it. And so this person is seized, and it turns out it's their guide, the European men's guide, mm-hmm. Into the kingdom, and gets put into the jail to be held. And the Europeans sort of carry on. She's very explicit that he's nothing to do with them. This isn't a conspiracy. Just, Xanadu knows that there's something different about this particular person, and when she visits the cells, it's the stranger again. Mm-hmm. But this time the stranger doesn't know her, but she knows him.
Oh, okay, yeah. Time fuckery.
That's it. You learn, as the story goes on, you learn a lot more about the stranger. He's not just, he doesn't just travel in time or live a long time. He travels just everywhere,
yeah.
Any time, any place. And it does seem like it is sequential, the fact that he knows her, sequential to him, as in he knows her at one stage but not at another. So, you know, there was a point where he's travelled back and then forward, back and forward, but there is purpose and sequence to what he's doing, just isn't what the same as everybody else's.
It's like Doctor Who.
Pretty much, yeah. There is, in Khan's kingdom, there is a conspiracy. There are his own people, some of his own people quite high up are conspiring to rebel against him. Well, not rebel against him, they want to take it down his power. They don't like the way he's running things. And to do that, they try to implicate the Europeans into raping one of, the current Khan's current favourite, mm-hmm. Wife. And they almost, they, unfortunately, they sort of succeed, but they, you know, they manage to, Madame Xanadu sees this, manages to intercept it with Marco Polo's help. Mm-hmm. She says, you know, you can't, you must make sure you're not, they know this wasn't you. So he rescues them and the relationship's kept again. Mm-hmm. Xanadu's got a lot of questions for the stranger. She doesn't understand why he's around, what his purpose is and what he's doing. And once again, he gives her some advice to do. You know, you did the right thing. He wanted her to make sure that when she visited themselves before the attack, she wanted to make sure that she knew that Marco Polo was going to be the key person and to make sure that he isn't implicated in any kind of way of what's about to happen. But she will need his help for it. So he's almost guiding her, but with no purpose. She doesn't understand. She seems to be doing all his work. She's lost her flipping powers. As a result of this, as a result of trying to help the favourite wife.
Yeah.
Marco Polo is rewarded by Khan. Obviously, you know, you've done a great thing. You saved me. And with Xanadu, you know, again, he's like, you implemented it. You were part of the rescue. Thank you. I'll always be indebted to you. What do you, what do you want? And she doesn't understand why his favourite's not there anymore.
Well,
because she was raped in his eyes.
He just gets rid of her.
Yeah, spoiled. I mean, he almost has a sense of regret in the tone, but at the same time,
that's just how it works.
Yeah, she's not going to be his favourite any longer.
I think that, okay, yeah, that makes sense. And those are the first.
They're the first two. They are different to the rest in terms of they're quite standalone. As the story goes on, there are things that you learn about. There are things entwining and brewing. Yeah. You do. One thing in this story of Khan, Marco Polo selects a treasure as his reward, and he selects a lamp, a proper genie in the lamp.
Right.
And Xanadu's mesmerised by it. She touches it and she gets a flicker of her once was power.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something obviously otherworldly about this, magical about this lamp. So she canters out, which is quite interesting.
Mm.
The other story is there's a story where she's in... it's gone completely from my mind. Where she is in...
A bathtub?
No.
A jam?
A jam. No, I'm in a jam. She's not in a jam. She is in a French, prestigious, short-lived... Marie Antoinette.
Oh.
Yes. So Louis the... God, whichever one it was at the time. Louis the Sixth? So
James would probably know.
Yeah, he would. So they're in France, in regal France, as it once was, and now she is Madame Xanadu. Xanadu was the name of the palace in Khan's time.
I don't know if it distracted you when I was looking something up, but that's from a poem. In Xanadu did Kublai Khan a stately pleasure dome decree.
Oh.
That's from Coleridge. It's called Kublai Khan.
Yeah, so she's in Marie Antoinette's time, as we know that how that story went.
It doesn't end well, does it?
No, it doesn't end well. And we're seeing, as the stories go on, and she's moving, she moves forward in time. And each story, there's the Marie Antoinette, then there's Jack the Ripper.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're catching up. We're in the 21st century by then. We're the 20th century by then, not 21st century.
To the 1900s.
Yeah, pretty much.
I always get confused by that.
It's the 20th century, isn't it? The 1900s. So we sort of... Jack the Ripper was early 1900s. And then we're going into sort of... She moves from... She's moving countries as this goes on. So she's in France, then she's in London.
Mm-hmm.
And then she goes on to America during the 1950s. From the Marie Antoinette story, you see how Xanadu is changing. Her innocence is going because she keeps getting sort of betrayed. Not just by the stranger, mm-hmm. but... She can see the future. So when she wants to warn the people she cares about and they dismiss her or they don't pay attention and then something happens to them, then she feels awful for not doing, you know, she's like, I'm not going to get involved. And she feels awful because she doesn't get involved and tries to rectify it and then basically gets it thrown back in her face.
Mm.
And that's the running theme that goes on. She gets quite bitter towards the end of this trade in the 1950s. She's very bitter. She's fed up. She's fed up the stranger just flouncing into her life, telling her what to do, and then doing it off again. And she wants to know more. She wants to know what's going on. And by the time of the end of the first trade, she's regained some of her powers back again. Not full strength as she was before, but she has managed to become the Xanadu as we know later on. There is one thing I will say. In the 1950s, she meets another pure magic magician.
Mm-hmm.
Who is a magician in this story. His name is John Zatara.
Oh, so Zatanna's dad.
Yes.
Is that Zatanna's dad?
It is Zatanna's dad.
Their names are stupid.
I know. Wow.
Zatara and Zatanna.
Yeah. I think they're Italian.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure Italian. But Madame Xanadu has a bit of a thing with him. And when I was reading, and I can remember thinking about to reading Justice League Dark, and I'm like, oh no, you slept with Zatanna's dad. That's just all sort of wrong.
It's a different Zatanna, I guess. Is she, first I want to say, the book's called Disenchanted, which kind of...
Oh, sorry, yes, Disenchanted,
means,
yeah.
Means losing your powers, but right, also means losing your innocence as well.
Yeah.
That's kind of...
Well, yeah, sorry, yeah.
Stuff. Which is quite clever. Well, no, I thought it was just a good name for a first book, but it's actually what it's about.
Yes, it is pretty much what it's about. I really like how you've got historical, whether or not completely accurate, but familiar stories of historical characters and how Madame Xanadu's character is so tightly and brilliantly woven into each story and she has a place. It doesn't disrupt if anything's going on. You keep up with... what she's doing, you keep up with the story, that's something you're familiar with. The Jack the Ripper one's pretty... It's not the most disgusting... Well, no, it's not disgusting at all. It's not the most gritty thing I've read in a comic book at all, but the juxtaposition of this in amongst the other stories is quite jarring. Well,
it's quite hard because it's quite recent history, it feels like, isn't it?
And it does still sit there really nicely as a story. Each story is quite a standalone, but Xanadu... progresses, she changes, she grows up, she becomes, you know, she evolves, she responds to what's going on, she becomes the characters we saw her at the end of Madame Xanadu, and it's, you know, the very end.
The first two stories you explained there, you described there, are basically about women being fucked over.
Yeah, I think, well, and as Marie Antoinette and with Jack the Ripper and later on in 1950 story, it is about, there is that element to it as well. It's very subtly done and it's not sort of shoved in your face, here's what's going on. But you're right, there's the shift of the power as it goes along. But as we learn in the later issues, that evens out. There isn't so much of the gender imbalance.
But is she quite a feminist? The I'm trying to remember what you guys used to say about the stories, but Xanadu herself does kind of... They're quite feminine stories, aren't they?
Yes, yeah.
So...
They are quite feminine stories. But it doesn't... It's not a hating on men.
It doesn't rub your nose in it, but
gosh.
You just find out in this book why maybe she's got preoccupations about, like... not protecting women, but sort of... She's been screwed over by guys and she's seen it happen a lot, sort of thing.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Well, and not just guys, as it turns out, so just people betraying her in general. But there is definitely the female element in the stories and the selected parts of time as well and how women were portrayed then. Yeah. But it all fits together really well. It still makes a really great story.
No, it sounds really good. I mean, I find it intriguing because while you were I was trying to remember what I'd heard you and James say about the stories before.
Sorry, it's 1930s, not 1950s. Right, sorry, 1950s is where I've picked up from.
While you were talking about those, especially those first two chapters, I was trying to think. Well, this sounds like it's setting her up to. I was getting a vague memories that kind of ties into how she is later, that it's consistent with it. That's quite cool. The other thing I wanted to ask, though, is because I can't remember if we've actually talked about it before, how similar is she to the version in the 52... I know in the 52 version, there was a whole thing about her and Zatanna wearing much skimpier clothes.
Yeah, she's definitely got her... She's nicked Power Girl's boob window.
Mm-hmm.
She's dressed... the same but differently. Mm. I think with Justice League Dark, they're trying to make them the not superheroes but superheroes. They're a collective team, so they have the traits of how collective supers teams have. But she hasn't, to be honest. She was quite heavily in the Eye Vampire and Justice League Dark crossover.
Mm-hmm.
And she was doing what she does best, which is use her magic to help a situation. But she, as she can foretell the future, she knew how things were going to work out. And again, reading this, you see that she's always had the element of wanting to intervene and stop bad things. That hasn't gone away at all. But where it's a team, it's hard to get a taste of who she is on her own. And because I read Xanadu, so I knew more about her. I mean, I've read a little bit about John Constantine. And John Constantine is just going to be the same wherever he is, I think.
Yeah.
But then the character's not familiar with at all, so I probably, when I was reading it, was probably picking up more on them because I hadn't read them before, so they stood out a bit more to me. I am enjoying Justice League Dark. I do want to see where it goes, but I think I'm not really a team-orientated comic book person. I think that's quite clear. I think that... I will see how the next arc goes with that and see how I get on with it. But I don't think it's because of the way that Madame Xanadu's been written or any of the characters. I think
they're a really different dynamic.
Yeah,
aren't
they really are different stories in different ways, and it is it's not something that I'm entirely sold on. So I think I will. But I love Jeff Lemire's writing, so I'll give it a little bit longer and see how it goes.
You didn't read Demon Knights, did you? Because I think Madame Xanadu's in that as well. But it's like set in the...
No, that was the Constantine.
I think it might be set in Arthurian times, though.
Oh, right. After
Demon Knights, it's weird. There might be a book coming out. I can't remember if that's one of the ones that's still going or if it's been culled. But it's got the demon...
Yeah, I know. And, I've seen the cover. I think... No, I didn't pick up any of those. No.
I know she's in it. I read the first issues of all of them. And I can't really remember if it squares with what you're saying. But it's probably... does. She's not a very well-known character, is she?
She isn't, and so. I haven't really done my research, but I was talking to James about it the other day. She was sort of like almost a D-list character
absolutely.
From Vertigo, but and I there were previous stories, but when Matt Wagner got hold of her and turned her into something much, you know, much better, did, you know, he was good for her, basically, made this very all-rounder character that anybody can enjoy. Mm. Anybody can enjoy this. And just did her justice, basically. Mm. And I think that's the one thing you always fear when someone else picks up the character, is like, I really like her. Don't mess with her too much.
Yeah, because, you know, Matt Wanger's left a mark on you, hasn't he?
So that's it.
You like it? It's
yes,
good.
I
sounds
like
really
it.
Good.
I'll pick up the second one, even though I'm pretty sure I've got all of the issues of the second one, but it's definitely worth getting. Oh, I got it for
$9.99.
That's really
cheap.
Forbidden
it's a really,
Planet,
really super thick volume.
Yes, it's chunky book. You get a lot for your money.
Blimey. No, thanks for that, Jane. That sounds really good. When you guys used to talk about it, I always talked about maybe picking it up in trade, but then I forgot by the time
Camelot. I kept forgetting where King Arthur was.
Camelot.
Yeah, Camelot. Sorry.
Not Spamalot.
Now I want to watch Spamalot.
So Camelot and Xanadu. No, hang on. Because Xanadu's like one of those places like Camelot, where it's famous, because that's where Kublai Khan did the thingy.
The other thing I was looking up, the reason
I got so confused by the whole Kublai Khan thing was there are only really two classic poems that I know at all well, and in my head they kind of blur into one, and I thought they were by the same person, but they're not. There's the Kublai Khan one,
mm-hmm.
Which is by Coleridge, and there's the I am Ozymandias, King of Kings, look upon my works, ye mighty, and despair, which is by Shelley.
Oh,
and because you were talking about Ozymandias as well, I was like, I had that sudden Kevin Bacon moment. Are they both by the same writer? Yeah. Because I'm an idiot. I'd have been a lousy English student.
I should have probably... But that's it, Matt Wagner has a great way of just fusing things together so seamlessly that you don't... I mean, I didn't know... I'm familiar with the poem, but I'm not so familiar with it. It didn't even twig. It just felt like a really nice way of how she gets her name and how she becomes Madame Xanadu.
Yeah.
She picks up a bit from each era she's in and adds it to her.
That's quite cool. Yeah. That's cool. I think that's us almost done, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know if we've got any contributions.
I think Mr. Max has done one.
Another one. Did you listen? The one he did last week about dog noises was brilliant.
I have not listened to last week's.
That makes it sound a bit weird. But he did one about dog noises. It was weird and awesome. So that's good. So thank you, contributors.
Thank you, contributors.
Thank you for listening to us. Do you know what you're doing this week, Jane?
Oh my God, yeah, it's my birthday next week.
It's your birthday next week.
I keep forgetting it's my birthday next week. Yes, it's my birthday next week. So there'll be lots of sweets and presents. I only know I've got presents because people have told me they've got presents. Mm.
So that's what day next week?
That's on the Tuesday.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yes, but I'm missing the podcast next week.
Yeah.
Because I'm also not at work for a week, so I'll be doing lots of fun, exciting things.
So it'll be me and James.
So it'll be as equally as weird without me next week.
We can do it naked, though, so that's good.
Do you have enough baby lotion?
I don't know if there's enough baby lotion in the world, but yeah, I don't know. So that's what you're. So his birthday is very exciting.
Yeah, it seems to be everyone's birthday at the moment. Yours kicked off the birthday season.
It did. It's about what you're about 19 or 20 now.
Oh, thanks. I'm 10.
No, that's weird.
So I'll be relaxing and enjoying my time off. What about you, Nick?
We have in-laws are coming down tomorrow, so that's nice. It's always really nice to see them. And Amy's dad is very sort of handy with household, like, stuff around the house and stuff. So hopefully he'll get so annoyed with a couple of the outstanding little DIY jobs around the house that he'll do them for us, which would be brilliant.
Okay.
And then I believe Amy has a friend over at the weekend, so I'll be playing lots of PC games. Because when her friends come over, they sit and chat and drink wine, and I stick my headphones on and I play Total War. And I played so much Shogun Total War last week that sometimes when things go quiet at work or when I'm trying to go to sleep, I start hearing the music that plays when in the middle of a battle in that game. So, which you know you're in trouble at that point.
Yeah, I was going to say, you should probably stop playing it for a while.
Did you ever play so much Tetris that when you closed your eyes or when you were trying to sleep, you'd try and fit blocks in shapes around the room?
No, I didn't.
I think people suffer from that a bit.
With putting stuff in a car. I knew someone who completed Tetris. Oh, spoiler alert.
Completed it? That doesn't make sense.
Well, finished it. Yeah. Finished all the levels on Tetris on his... Game Boy Advance, and it made a rocket.
It made a rocket.
Yep.
Out of the Game Boy Advance, or just on the screen?
No, just on the screen. That would have been so much better.
Yeah. Oh, in Wikipedia style news, because obviously I was very good with the poetry just then.
You were.
Last night at the pub before the cinema, we were talking about music from games. Music that gets stuck in your head, and Domi and her lovely fiancé Jamie were talking about the Tetris music,
mm-hmm.
which I think a lot of people think is just video game music, but it's actually from an old Russian folk song.
Oh.
So that's why it sounds a bit Russian-y.
Okay.
But I knew that, and I looked it up on Wikipedia, and I proved it. I can't remember what it was, like some Russian word, though. Jensky Flensky.
It's funny that you use Wikipedia to prove your point.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's unlikely that someone else has screwed things up as much as, like, you know, someone who would go on Wikipedia and add stuff would get stuff as wrong as me. So in these cases, I think it at least gives me a little bit more validation, so that's good. I was right about John Travolta as well. I'm glad all that's happened recently. Because in the whole time Amy and I have known each other, I have told Amy about rumours I had heard that John Travolta occasionally performed gay acts. I'm not judging, but just that he does in airports and places like that. And she always said, well, I've never heard it anywhere. You're just crazy. And then when you did a Google search, you couldn't find anything about it either. And I wondered if maybe I just made it up. But apparently, more recently, it has become a thing in
maybe
the proper
news. Maybe it's
your
sixth sense, knowing
like
things before they
stuff in advance.
Yeah.
I think it's...
really meaningless trivia things.
It might be. Actually, in the case of John Travolta, I think it's more that the Church of Scientology has an awful lot of really high-powered lawyers.
Yes.
Who shut these things down before they get much traction.
Yes,
but we'll see how that works out for them in the next few weeks.
Yeah.
So I think that's it. That's us, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Thank you.
Thank you for listening, listeners. We're outie.
Bye-bye.
It's a lot easier to coordinate the bye-bye when there's only two of us.
Yeah.